Saw the shadow of the Blue Queen, Arsinoe says. And it pointed back to Fenburn. All through breakfast, Mirabella tries to eat as though nothing is wrong. She butters her toast and drops sugar into her tea, pretends to listen to Mrs. Chatworth and Jane gossip about the governor's wife's birthday party, or coo over the little dog and the ribbon on his collar. Only Billy seems aware that anything is amiss, his gaze flitting from the dark circles beneath Arsinoe's eyes to Mirabella's tense fingers and then back again. They had barely slept. They had simply sat side by side on Arsinoe's bed until the candles had burned down to nubs. Finally, in the early gray hours of pre-dawn, Arsinoe had lain down and let her eyes drift shut. But the moment she closed them, the muttering commenced. Mirabella shook her awake, but every time she slept, it would begin again. Mirabella does not know what the dreams mean, or if they are true visions or simply nightmares. She does not know if Arsinoe really saw the shadow of the Blue Queen, though her hands ache from clinging to the crumpled paper of Arsinoe's drawing. All she knows is what she can feel, that it is the island reaching out for them again.
"A party at the governor's grand estate," exclaims Jane,
as if they had not already been talking about it for the last half hour. "Indeed," Mrs. Chatworth says, tapping into a soft-boiled egg and feeding a bit to her new pet. At least that idea of Arsinoe's seems to have gone smoothly. "We will need a new jacket for you, Billy. I saw one in the shops that will do. And Jane, you must wear your new lilac silk. There will be plenty of eligible bachelors there. Perhaps I can marry off both of my children in one afternoon." At the mention of Billy's marriage, Arsinoe stops eating, and Mirabella turns to Billy with an arched eyebrow. He clears his throat.
"I'm not looking for a wife, Mother."
"Christine Holland is a fine choice. Everyone in the city knows she has set her cap at you."
"Mother, did you not hear what I said?"
"And did you not hear what I said?" Mrs. Chatworth asks. "Your father, it seems, is in no hurry to return from—"
She glances sidelong at Mirabella and Arsinoe.
"That place. And without him, our creditors will come calling. The partners will push us out. And before you know it, the estate at Hartford will be gone. And this townhouse will be gone, and the business will be gone, and we will be ruined. And all you need to do to save us is ask for Christine Holland's hand."
"If I ask for her foot instead, do you think they'll just give us a loan?" Billy asks,
and Arsinoe barks surprised laughter into her napkin.
"May we be excused?" Mirabella asks and grabs her.
"I am afraid my sister and I have slept poorly. Perhaps a bit of fresh air."
"I'll join you," Billy says and starts to rise.
"You will not. You'll stay and come to the shops with Jane and me to be fitted for your jacket. And you,"
Mrs. Chatworth fixes her gaze on Mirabella,
"you and your sister are my guests, and how you conduct yourselves reflects on my house. Make sure to take your parasols, and make sure she wears a dress."
Mirabella assures her that she will, though it will be easier said than done, and pushes Arsinoe gently up the stairs. Not 10 minutes later, Billy knocks at their door and pokes his head in.
"I've managed to put my mother off jacket shopping for the time being," he says and glances at Arsinoe,
who is still dressed in trousers and one of his old shirts. Mirabella gestures to her sister helplessly. She has it in her mind that she should start passing herself off as a boy.
"It's my fault, I suppose,"
he softly closes the door,
"for letting her have so many of my clothes."
"Don't talk about me like I'm not here,"
Arsinoe says from her dresser, where she is rummaging through drawers. "Billy, would you lend me a pair of your socks? I know how protective you are of them, but you have several dozen pair."
"And I've lent you at least 5 pair already. What have you done with those?"
"Does it look like I know?"
She tosses long white stockings and other frilly underclothes out of the drawer and onto the floor.
Just give me the socks, will you, Henry?
She stops. Who's Henry? Billy asks. Arsinoe turns and quickly walks past him to search under Mirabella's bed.
No one, she says. Isn't that your middle name? William Henry Chatworth, Jr.?
She comes up brandishing black socks.
You know it isn't, Billy says.
Now, who is Henry?
She will explain later.
Mirabella takes Arsinoe by the shoulder and tugs her through the door, even as she struggles to put on her last shoe. If I do not get her out of the house soon, your mother will change her mind and confine us to our room.
That was close,
Arsinoe whispers as they walk down the front steps. Mirabella grasps her by the elbow.
You are in far better spirits than I would expect, considering.
Well, I got more sleep than you did.
Arsinoe ventures a smile, but it fades when Mirabella is unmoved.
I can't explain it. The dreams are good dreams. They feel safe.
And the Blue Queen's shadow? Did she feel safe?
Arsinoe swallows.
No, she felt like a threat.
So what are we going to do?
I don't know. Maybe nothing. Maybe it won't happen again.
Mirabella takes her sister by the arm.
Neither you nor I believe that, she says. So you had better take me back to where it started.
Let us go back to Joseph's grave.
You haven't been back here, have you? Arsinoe asks, as she leads Mirabella down the groomed path of the cemetery.
No. Not since the day they erected the grave marker.
Mirabella has thought about it, and about him many times, but she has never visited.
It does not feel that I have the right, when she cannot.
I don't think Jules would begrudge him visitors.
Perhaps, but that is not the only reason. I also do not like to think of him rotting underground, when he should be ashes on the wind,
ashes in the water.
When he should be alive.
Yes, Mirabella agrees. When he should be alive. They reach Joseph's grave and step into the shade of the elm trees. It is hard to believe that he is really there, under that dirt, beneath that smooth patch of green grass. Mirabella cannot feel him. But then they had so few days together. Sometimes she does not trust her own recollection of his eyes or his smile, the sound of his voice. But she had loved him. He had loved Jules, but Mirabella had loved him for those brief few days.
Why here? Mirabella asks as Arsinoe drops to a crouch beside the headstone. Why at Joseph's grave?
I think it started here because he's a piece of the island.
Arsinoe touches the earth.
I think with him and me together, she was able to find me. And maybe because of...
She makes a fist.
What? Madrigal said once that low magic was the only kind of magic that worked outside of the island. And maybe because I've done so much of it, the island is able to find me.
She pulls up her sleeve and studies her scars.
Maybe I burn like a beacon.
Mirabella's eyes wander over the slashes of raised pink on her sister's arm, the pocked marks inside her hands. They are different from the bear's claw marks across her face. There is something about them, something disturbingly useful.
If that is true, then I like this even less, Mirabella mutters. Low magic has never been trustworthy.
It saved me often enough, Arsinoe says.
Not without cost, and not only to you.
Mirabella's eyes flicker to the dirt of Joseph's grave. It was an unconscious movement, but Arsinoe sees it and grimaces.
I did not mean that, Arsinoe. I only mean, we should hope the dreams are only dreams.
And the Shadow Queen is only what?
Another dream.
Mira, I was awake. Barely. Arsinoe scowls and Mirabella softens her tone.
Tell me what you dreamed of this morning, when you fell asleep again.
Arsinoe hesitates, as though she would keep it to herself. When she finally tells her, she keeps her eyes on the dirt.
I dreamed that I was her again.
Who?
Daphne?
Arsinoe cocks her head and shrugs, a gesture she has taken up from the mainlanders.
The Lost Queen of Fenburn.
There is no Lost Queen of Fenburn.
Do you want to hear this or not?
Mirabella exhales and motions for her to continue.
I dreamed we stole away on a ship bound for Fenburn to help Henry Redville in his suit.
She closes her eyes as though remembering and sniffs, searching for scraps of the dream as if they might carry through the memory.
Her plan is to befriend the queen, to enter into her confidence so she can steer her toward Henry. But I think she's going to want Henry for herself.
And then what? Mirabella interrupts.
After she stowed away, what happened?
Then we were back on Fenburn. We got off the boat, dressed as a boy, and made our way to the queen.
You met Queen Ilion? You met the Blue Queen?
Arsinoe nods gravely.
I have been back there. Back on the island. Back on the docks in Barden Harbor and in the Volroy.
Mirabella turns away, shaking her head.
This cannot be real. The more Arsinoe talks, the closer the island feels, as if she could look out past the bay and it would be there, leering back at them.
She squeezes her eyes closed.
So this missing queen, she has met the Blue Queen and not been recognized?
How?
Did she truly believe Daphne was a boy?
No, Ilion saw past that right away.
But Daphne moves like a mainlander. She talks like one. And according to everyone on the island, Ilion's sisters have all been dead for a very long time. She's never had to look over her shoulder and guard her crown. She was the queen crowned since birth. Not like us.
And this Daphne, she knows nothing?
Nothing, Arsinoe says sadly. She doesn't even know she's an elemental. Her gift has been so long stunted. But I've seen her moods affect the weather. Subtle changes. Her gift is dormant from so many years away from the island, but it's still there.
Wait. If Daphne truly is, was, a lost elemental queen, then why is she speaking to you? Why not me?
Irritation flickers across Arsinoe's face. I do not say that because it should be me, Mirabella explains, because I should be chosen. Only that like speaks to like, elemental to elemental.
Arsinoe nods.
I don't know why. Maybe she's more like me than like you. She smuggled herself off Centra by dressing in boys' clothes and sneaking onto a boat to Fenburn along with Henry's horses. I've never smelled so much manure in one place. And then there's the fact that she's essentially an orphan, at the mercy of Henry's family's charity.
That makes her like both of us, says Mirabella with a frown.
Maybe it's something else, then.
Arsinoe rises to her feet and trails her hand along Joseph's headstone. She pauses on the inscription, on the line that reads, A friend to queens and cougars. Then she clenches her fist.
The low magic. It has to be the low magic. And I'm marked through.
She turns toward Mirabella, with a devious glint in her eyes.
Perhaps if we marked you with it as well?
Absolutely not.
Well, what do you want me to do then? Stop dreaming? Stop sleeping?
Mirabella sighs. She cannot very well ask that.
And besides, she knows her sister.
Arsinoe will follow this queen to whatever answers and whatever end there may be, no matter the risks.
Just promise me that you will not keep secrets, that you will tell me everything. no matter what it is. The Volroy.
Catherine walks through the rose garden on the east side of the castle, a small cloistered space, very private, with full bushes of roses of every color. It has been difficult to find a moment of peace in the days since the mist brought the bodies. Everyone is afraid, and no one has answers. Examination of the bodies themselves has yielded no explanations, and the mist continues to behave strangely, rising when it should not rise, thicker and closer to the shore than normal. Catherine reaches out to cradle a large red bloom in the palm of her hand. It is the dead naturalist queens who have lured her into the garden, craving sunshine and the scent of green, growing things. But Catherine cannot bloom the rose. She cannot make it grow, any more than she can make it wither and die. The borrowed gifts are not true gifts, after all. The borrowed naturalist gift gives her a sure hand with the royal horses and hounds, but she cannot command them. The borrowed war gift makes her skilled with knives, but it does not let her move them. The dead poisoners let her eat the poison, but could not stop the poison from corrupting her.
Queen Catherine.
Catherine releases the rose and turns. It is High Priestess Luca with Genevieve, of all people. An unlikely pair, she says as they bow.
Unlikely indeed, says Luca. Genevieve stepped into my shadow the moment I stepped outside the castle, almost as if she does not trust me to be alone with the queen.
Genevieve sighs, but says nothing. It is not worth denying.
We have decided to release the bodies of the searchers for burning, Luca says.
But, says Catherine, we still do not know why or how,
and we may never. But the bodies will reveal no more secrets, and the families have waited long enough. The longer they are kept, the more time the people will have to murmur wild speculation and incite a panic.
Catherine frowns, her mind a flicker of images from the day of the banquet. So many bodies rolled onto the sand, fish-bitten and mutilated, or pristine and pale. As she thinks, a bee lands on the back of her hand, and Luca's eyes flicker to it. Catherine lets it crawl a moment and then brushes it off.
There are still questions unanswered. Questions that the people will not just forget.
The people will accept the explanation of the temple, that the searchers fell to a tragic accident at sea.
And the mist?
The mist delivered them home.
Luca looks to Genevieve, as though for support, and to Catherine's surprise, she acquiesces.
People want the soothing answer, Genevieve says. They want the answer that allows them to go on with their everyday lives. Let the temple give a statement. Let the High Priestess wield what influence she has. It is, after all, why we allowed her a seat at the table.
Well put, says Luca, her expression sour.
Go ahead, Catherine says and clenches her jaw.
But though the people may forget, I will not. I will not forget that my searchers met with violent ends, that they sailed and died within days, yet some appeared to have been dead for weeks.
The High Priestess gazes over the line of rose bushes. She gazes over them for so long that Catherine thinks she will change the subject and comment instead on the blooms or the weather.
I remember when your sister tried to flee through the mist, says Luca. Do you remember? You were separated by that time, of course, but you must have heard, living here with the Arryns. I was there, when they found them bobbing in their boat. They could not have been gone from Sealhead Cove for more than a night, yet their little faces were gaunt, and they had drunk all their water.
Catherine swallows as the High Priestess looks back at her.
No one spoke of it then, There were too many other things, pressing things, to distract us. But even those who the mist allows to pass through remark on it. Those who sail from the mainland, those who trade. Time and distance do not mean the same things within the mist. Nothing means the same thing within the mist. As much as we would like to know what befell your searchers, we will probably never know. And with that, the High Priestess bows and walks away.
She is an irksome old thing, Genevieve says after Luca is gone. But I think she is right. Better to put this incident behind us. The people see the mist as the guardian of the island. For it to behave so alarmingly. We are lucky it has been quiet since then. And who knows? This story the High Priestess spins about the mist bringing the bodies home to you? Maybe it will work. Maybe it is even true.
In case it is not, says Katarine, I would learn more about the mist. Perhaps even about the Blue Queen who created it. Will you look into it for me, Genevieve? Discreetly.
If you wish. One of the bees hovering near the roses buzzes too close to Genevieve's hair, and she waves her hand at it. Then she cries out when it stings her on the finger.
Now you have killed it.
It stung me.
And how many times did you sting me as a child? Stop being such a baby about it.
Genevieve bows and stalks out of the garden, sucking on her wounded finger. As a poisoner with a strong gift, the venom from the bee's sting will not even cause swelling. It will not be more than a momentary pain. Katarine looks back at the roses. The dead naturalist queens always make her feel the calmest, drawing her into the flowers or urging her toward the stables to ride. But the talk of the mist has put all the dead sisters on edge.
You know as well as I do, she says to them. The mist is not finished.
The Mainland. In the morning, Arsinoe and Mirabella get ready for the governor's wife's birthday party.
We must try to be polite, Mirabella says, as she stands behind Arsinoe at their vanity table, trying to pin Arsinoe's short black hair to the sides of her head. We must try to smile at Mrs. Chatworth and Miss Jane.
I'll try.
Arsinoe coughs as Mirabella puffs loose powder over the redness of her scar. But when she is done, it only looks like a powdered scar. Her mark of the bear refuses to hide.
We are here on their goodwill, on their charity.
I know, it's just harder to move on for some of us.
In the mirror, Mirabella's face falls.
I didn't mean that, Arsinoe says.
I just meant you're better at pretending to be one of them in a crowd.
Only because I am already used to wearing dresses.
We should hurry and choose yours, not the gray. It looks like a potato sack. What about the blue, with the black ribbon at the hem?
No, says Arsinoe.
No dresses. A jacket and vest will do.
Mirabella sighs and stops fussing with Arsinoe's hair.
What did you dream last night?
Do not lie. I dreamed of arranging secret meetings between Henry Redville and Queen Ilion to give him an advantage before she meets the other suitors at the disembarking.
Met, Mirabella says with a frown.
Met? This is all in the past. None of it can be changed. It is only some trick of the island, some lingering grasp it has on us.
And you were the girl again. Daphne?
I was.
Arsinoe squints at her sister in the mirror.
Did you know there are secret passageways hidden behind tapestries hanging in the Volroy?
How would I know that?
I have never been there except for the cells.
Nor have you.
Except that's how I snuck Henry through undetected.
Was there anything else about this dream? Mirabella asks. Anything important?
Did you see hints of why the Blue Queen would send you these visions? You said you thought Daphne in love with Henry herself, but we know he becomes Queen Ilion's king consort. Did it seem that Daphne would try to betray Queen Ilion? No. She and Ilion are already close friends. Is that why Ilion is giving me the dreams? Is she teaching me a lesson? I do not know. Mirabella turns away to dress herself. But until the governor's party is over, let us try to forget it. Governor Holland's mansion is just outside the city, a large estate surrounded by trees. As their carriage makes its way up the long circle drive, Arsinoe is reminded of the Black Cottage. The buildings have similar white exteriors and dark timbering, though the brick of the Holland Foundation is a bright red-orange. Not bad, she says and whistles. Hush. Mrs. Chatworth reaches across the carriage and slaps Arsinoe's shoulder. She has not spoken to her since she came down the stairs wearing trousers and a black vest.
She was paying them a compliment, Mother, says Billy.
He takes Arsinoe's hand.
Just keep her to the rear. Show Miss Mirabella to the front. At least she knows how to dress decently.
In ivory lace and green ribbon, Mirabella hardly looks like a queen at all. But that is what mainland fashion demands. The only thing Mrs. Chatworth complained about was her hair. She wanted ringlets, but Mirabella refused to use the hot metal iron. With her weakening gift, she could be burned. And Arsinoe imagines that for a girl who used to dance with fire, there could be nothing worse.
Wasn't half the reason you were invited to this party so that people could get a look at us? Christine would have invited Billy, but you and Jane were included to accompany the foreign wards.
What is your point, Miss Arsinoe?
My point is, I'm doing you a favor dressing like this.
She pulls on her lapels, smooths her hair back away from her facial scars.
Dressed like this? I'm more of an attraction.
Footmen help them from their carriage, and they are shown through the front door into an enormous, high-ceilinged foyer. Some relation of the governor, one of his younger daughters, his niece, perhaps, steps forward to receive them. Mrs. Chatworth inclines her head.
May I present Miss Mirabella Rowland, she says, and her sister, Miss Arsinoe.
At the introduction, the girl's eyes open wide.
We have heard much. How wonderful to meet you, finally.
Arsinoe and Mirabella nod and curtsy slightly, and the girl sweeps them through the house.
I don't know why we had to be Mirabella and Arsinoe Rowland, Arsinoe whispers as they follow.
We could not very well be Mirabella and Arsinoe Wolf Spring, Mirabella whispers back.
The governor's girl leaves them at the rear of the house, where a set of wide-open doors leads to the party. Arsinoe whistles again. The sprawling rear lawn boasts a small fountain and a well-kept hedge maze. Tables have been set and adorned with summer flowers, and there is even a stone dance floor and a small band of musicians. On the island, such a celebration would be reserved for a queen or a high festival.
Some birthday, Arsinoe says, watching guests as they mill about laughing or clump together with glasses of drink in their hands. Many ladies have opted for wide-brimmed hats instead of parasols.
Do not be sour, chides Mirabella.
Our own birthdays were high festival affairs as well. We were queens, she sighs. What I wouldn't give for a mug of ale, like we used to have at the Lion's Head.
Unlikely to find any of that here, Billy says, and takes her by the arm. Tea, certainly, or champagne.
Anything to put in front of my face. We may be foreign curiosities, but I hope they don't mean for us to meet everyone at this party.
Billy! Over here! Billy!
They turn. Christine Holland stands in the center of a group of young women. Arsinoe grimaces.
Oh, good. It's Miss Christine.
Go, Mrs. Chatworth says and prods them not too gently. Billy clears his throat.
I suppose we'll have to.
He leads the way, and Arsinoe turns to Mirabella to mouth the word, help. She will not get within an arm's length, Mirabella says, and snakes her arm through Billy's. Do the same on his other side. Arsinoe does, though it feels awkward. She cannot help noticing that Mirabella's stride has gotten markedly slinkier, and that with the both of them pressed tight against him, Billy is grinning like an idiot. Put on your best smile, Mirabella says cheerily through her teeth.
Just like a horse's, Arsinoe says cheerily through hers.
When they reach her, Christine offers Billy her hand to be kissed, but with both of his arms occupied, her fingers linger idly in the air before fluttering back down to her side. Mirabella glances at Arsinoe and lifts her chin in triumph.
I am so glad that you and the Mrs. Rowland could come.
Thank you for the invitation, says Billy. It's a lovely party.
Christine's smile is not as radiant as usual. She cannot stop looking at the way Mirabella leans against Billy. And with Mirabella there, the poor girl seems to have shrunk 3 sizes. Arsinoe feels sorry for her and tries to catch her eye to smile for real. But a boy approaches to extend his hand to Mirabella, and Christine's expression brightens.
Miss Rowland, he says, will you dance?
Oh, yes, you must,
Christine exclaims before Mirabella can respond.
The band my father chose is absolutely delightful.
Mirabella looks between the boy and Arsinoe.
Please, Christine nudges. Billy cannot have thought he could keep you all to himself.
Mirabella slides her arm free and takes the boy's hand. I will be right back. But she will not be. The boys are already forming a queue beside the stone dance floor. Arsinoe wonders how well she will fare. The music on the mainland is so different from the music of home. There are no somber strings and woodwinds, like in Rowland. No cheerful fiddle, like Ellis and Luke played in Wolf Spring. This stuff is played mostly on horns, by musicians wearing shirts striped like pulled taffy. Once Mirabella is gone, Christine wastes no time. She reaches for Billy's empty arm and tugs him to her side, sliding her gaze over Arsinoe's vest and trousers. Then she taps him on the shoulder.
There is someone here I want you to meet.
She cranes her neck, a perfectly smooth and elegant neck, Arsinoe notes, and points to a young boy racing across the lawn.
There he is, my little cousin.
They laugh as the child tumbles and pops back up in his tiny, handsome suit.
He is just the sort of boy that I will have someday. A fine son, for a father to be proud of. Isn't he darling?
He is, Billy agrees.
He certainly is, says Arsinoe. Isn't that the sort of boy that you would like someday, Billy? A fine boy, and a fine woman to raise him.
Arsinoe snorts, unintentionally, and Christine's pretty smile falters.
Perhaps you should go and dance as well, Miss Arsinoe. That is, if there is anyone here who is willing. Perhaps I should knock you on your...
I'm willing.
Billy extricates himself from Christine's grip and slips his arm around Arsinoe's waist.
And as for a son, Christine, I think I would prefer a little girl with a smart mouth and who only ever wears trousers.
They walk away together, and Arsinoe cannot resist looking back. Christine's entire face has turned red with fury.
Well, Billy says nervously, what are they doing?
She looks like she's about to scream. Arsinoe laughs. Your mother is not going to be happy about this.
My mother will get used to it. She'll have to be content to my agreeing to go to school in the fall.
To school?
Yes, Billy says. I should have told you sooner.
Tell me now. He nods and turns them away from the dance floor to find someplace quiet. It takes a while, on an estate the size of the governor's. But finally, the sounds of the party are muted, and they stop on a soft knoll of grass between the stables and the carriage house. This is nicer. Arsinoe plops down onto Billy's jacket after he spreads it out for them. Some of those people were staring at me so hard, I thought their eyeballs were going to pop past their lids.
Here.
He hands her a glass of champagne he had taken off a tray as they passed.
It's not ale, but it's better than nothing.
She stares intently at the bubbles. Do you think it could be poisoned?
It isn't likely.
What a pity.
I didn't think your gift worked here, he says.
I don't think it does.
She downs the glass in one gulp.
Still a pity. He sits down beside her, and for a moment they recline in the comfort of each other's company. Alas, it does not last long.
You understand why I have to go to school, he says.
Yes, of course. It's what's done here, isn't it? Go to school and then into business with your father.
Unless I'm disinherited, Billy says,
and laughs without much humor. Do you think that's why he hasn't come back?
No, actually. The fact that he hasn't come back makes me think I have hope. If he's staying away to punish me, then that's a good sign. If he was going to disinherit me, he would just come home and draw up the papers.
Are you and your family really going to be all right? Arsinoe asks. About the money, I mean?
Yes. No. I don't know.
He grins ruefully and sets his champagne in the grass.
It'll be fine. I'll figure it out somehow.
I wish I could give you all this, she gestures to the estate. But I haven't got it. You went to the island for a queen and a crown and came back with two extra mouths to feed. For goddess's sake, I'm borrowing your clothes.
And you look much better in them than I do. Listen, don't worry. My father's an arse, but he won't stay gone so long that he ruins us. If there's anything you can rely upon, it's his sense of self-preservation.
I'll admit, I sort of dread his return.
It'll be all right. But in the meantime, I'll go to school to please Mother.
He touches her chin.
I promised Joseph and Jules that I would take care of you, didn't I?
Arsinoe jerks loose. Jules should never have asked that. She was just so used to looking after me that she couldn't leave without someone else to take over. You should have said no.
I would never have said no, Arsinoe. Jules didn't really need to ask.
But maybe then she would have stayed. Except, now that she is here, Arsinoe knows that Jules could never have come to the mainland. The constraint and the ridiculous rules would have driven her mad. And what would have become of Camden had Jules's gift weakened? She would have become a wild thing, no longer a familiar, in a place where she would have been hunted or put in a cage. Junior, could you have ever belonged on the island? He raises his brows.
I don't know. For you, maybe.
But you would have been waiting to come home.
Is that what you're doing? Waiting to go home?
She shakes her head. There is no home for her on Fenburn either. It's just very different here. There's a lot to get used to.
Billy wraps his arms around her and pulls her down beside him. She rests her head on his shoulder and throws her leg across his. I miss Fenburn too, you know, he says.
Then he pauses before asking in alarm.
Do you think the Sandrins have eaten my chicken?
Arsinoe laughs. There are plenty of other chickens to eat besides Harriet. I'm sure she's fine. Spoiled even. Maybe she spends some of her days at the Malone house following Kate and Ellis around. Maybe she's met Luke's rooster, Hank, and they've made you some adorable chicken grandchildren.
Chicken grandchildren.
He laughs and pulls her closer.
I think I would like that.
Arsinoe nuzzles her face into his neck. Even on a hot summer day, she cannot seem to get close enough. Despite living in the same house, they have had so little time alone.
You know, if your mother finds us like this, she will call it a scandal.
Billy rolls onto her and grins.
Then we had better make it scandalous.
After a very pleasurable while, Arsinoe and Billy drift off in the afternoon sun, and Arsinoe dreams. She slides into Daphne's body and finds herself at Innisfool, and there is only one reason for so many to have gathered there. It must be the Beltane Festival. In the dream, Daphne regards herself in the long, polished mirror. She dresses always as a boy on Fenburn, always as she wishes. How fondly she runs her hands over the doublet and hose and the ends of her short hair. The folk of Fenburn know she is a girl, yet they do not treat her any differently than if she had successfully passed as a boy, which she does whenever she meets someone from her home country of Centra or Velostra or Salcades. She can dress as she pleases and move freely in all circles, and for the first time in her life, Daphne feels whole. Arsinoe peers out through Daphne's eyes as she stands beside the Blue Queen, Queen Ilion. Ilion reminds Arsinoe of Mirabella. They are both elementals, for a start, and Ilion is nearly as beautiful, with long black hair shining to her waist, and intelligent eyes edged by thick black lashes. She is also just as elegant and assured of her crown as Mirabella was when they first met. So sure that her sisters had been killed as babies, that the sight of a black-haired, black-eyed girl from Centra caused not even a flicker of curiosity. But she is still not as strong as my sister, Arsinoe thinks, as attendants dress Ilion for the festival. Weaving around her and Daphne so quickly, it is a wonder they both do not wind up bound into the same gown. Ilion's elemental gift was for weather and water, a flickering of fire and nothing of earth. Not even the great Blue Queen was master of them all like Mirabella.
Are you sure I can't smuggle Henry off his ship?
Daphne asks, close to Queen Ilion's ear.
The suit has missed out on so much of the festival, and Henry loves to watch the mummers.
Mummers? Arsinoe searches her memory for the old word.
Play actors.
Absolutely not, Ilion smiles. The suitors remain on their ships until tonight's disembarking ceremony.
Even Henry? When he has met you already so many times before?
Ilion claps her hand across Daphne's mouth, laughing.
You are not even supposed to be here,
Ilion says, as her attendants clear out of the way, eyes rolling over their smiles. Inside Daphne's head, Arsinoe laughs along with them. It is still a strange sensation, disembodied, yet within a body. The sense is so keen that she can smell the sweet perfume on Ilion's palm.
Such a secret!
Daphne pries the queen's fingers loose.
I don't see what the trouble is when he will be your husband soon enough.
Perhaps, and perhaps not. There are still other suitors to meet tonight.
Other suitors? But what are they compared to my Henry? None of them will be as clever or as stout-hearted. None of them can calm a horse with a word and a touch.
He is lucky to have a friend who is so confident of his virtues.
A friend? What kind of friend would call him her Henry? And what kind of friend is he to look at Daphne like he does? Open your eyes, Ilion. Don't be made a fool.
Daphne sighs. She looks over Ilion's formal gown. The Blue Queen may be called blue, but may still wear only black.
Are you ready, then? Can we go and see the players, so I can tell Henry about them later?
With a smile, Ilion affixes her sheer, protective veil across her face and leads the way.
Yuck! Veils.
At least we didn't have to wear those. Or a doublet and hose. Goddess bless the girl who invented trousers.
They step out of the tent, and Arsinoe peers around curiously. Innisfool Valley has not changed much in the 400 years between Daphne and Ilion's time and Arsinoe's own. The cliffs and the view of Mount Horn remain the same, and the lushness of the long grass. The trees are different, though, smaller, and in varieties that no longer exist on that part of the island. They cast a different color and a shifting brand of shade, even the trees suggesting that this part of the island's history was a brighter time than the time of blood and secrets that Arsinoe was born into. Ilion pulls Daphne up onto a dais. Directly before it, a circle is opened up in the crowd to form an impromptu stage. And as they watch, actors in bright costumes prepare to present a scene for the queen's amusement. The lead actress steps to the fore and bows.
"We are a troupe from the Oracle City of Sunpool, and we present a scene in honor of Queen Ilion's birth."
It begins, and three young girls wrapped in swaddling cloths of green, gray, and pale blue, mime being born to a woman, playing a queen with a great, yellow-painted crown atop her head. Another woman, dressed all in shining black, with silver ribbons in her hair, descends upon the queen and wraps her in her arms.
The goddess, Arsinoe thinks. The goddess brings with her one more babe, a beautiful girl in bright blue and black, who bursts out from where she had been hidden in the goddess's skirts.
"Ilion!" the actors cry. "Ilion, blessed and blue!"
The crowd claps loudly, as does Ilion herself, with a soft laugh. The girl playing her twirls in delighted circles and touches each of her newborn sisters on the forehead, and they fall dead to the ground.
"If only it were really that easy. That clean."
The play ends, and Ilion places a garland of flowers around the neck of the actress she judges to have been the best, the girl who played the birthing queen. But though they received no garlands, every single actress comes to kiss the blue queen's robes.
"Why are you looking at me like that?" Ilion asks,
and Arsinoe feels Daphne blush.
"It's only, you're so different from what I expected. They really love you. You really love them.
That is what it is to be a queen.
Not where I come from.
Is Sintra truly such a terrible place? You rarely speak of it fondly. Am I to dread marrying Henry then, if after my reign we are to return there?" Ilion regards Daphne from the corner of her eye.
"You know, Daphne, that even if I do not choose Henry to be my king consort, you will always be welcome here."
"You would let me stay?" Daphne asks.
"Of course. You seem better suited for the island anyway. Perhaps that is why I love you so well and so quickly. You have the novelty and tales of a Sentren, but the spirit of the island.
Though I do not know if you would truly stay, if Henry must go." Arsinoe wishes for a mirror, to see what Daphne's expression gives away. But then the dream moves ahead, as dreams do of its own accord, time folding over on itself, so that day becomes night, and Arsinoe reels at the sudden change. They are on the cliffs now, atop the cliffs overlooking the bay. And from the fires and drums, Arsinoe knows what she is about to witness. She has witnessed it before, from near that same spot, in her red and black painted mask.
The disembarking ceremony.
Why Daphne is there, Arsinoe does not know. Perhaps because she was ashore already. Perhaps because she has become Ilion's new favorite. It does not matter. Daphne stands behind the queen, so close that Ilion's black skirt billows against the edge of Daphne's doublet. But they are not alone. So many maids and white and black-robed priestesses surround them that Arsinoe is surprised none have fallen off the rocks.
"It is nearly time,"
one says and giggles. And even in the darkness, lit only by flames, it is easy to see the blush in her cheeks. So many names pass by Arsinoe's ears. Suitors from Bevele and Velostra and Salcades. Nearly a dozen, far more than the five she had to face at her own ceremony.
Marcus James Brandon, says one of the maids. He has caught everyone's eye. He is the Duke of Bavon. It is a lesser principality of Salcades, but his family holds great favor with their king and have substantial mining interests. Gold and silver, I think.
Marcus James Brandon, the Duke of Bavon. Ilion grimaces. He has so many names. And what is a minor duke compared to Henry?
A duke from Salcades, the maid persists. Who commands the finest fleet of ships in the world?
So he's rich and has a navy. He'll trudge onto the beach decked out in velvet and slouching from the weight of the coin in his pockets.
There is some last-minute pushing and prodding as the maids change their minds about one of Ilion's bracelets and replace it with one of lapis lazuli stones. And none of them will stop gossiping, tittering about this or that suitor's piercing eyes and the pounding hearts of love. Arsinoe is glad that it is only a dream, and her true stomach is not there to be sick.
When they look at you tonight, someone exclaims, your gift will spark into a flame.
Arsinoe feels Daphne purse her lips.
As someone who has been privy to the inner circles of the women and of the men, Daphne says, I can tell you that the men on those ships are not talking about Ilion with such rosy-cheeked poetry.
From the top of the cliffs, all 11 ships are visible in the harbor with flags aloft. It is Ilion's nervous wind, the maids say, but Arsinoe cannot tell if that is true. Ilion looks like she always does, composed and focused, a queen born to rule. Then Ilion trembles, and over the bay, spiderweb-thin veins of dry lightning crack across the sky. Daphne gasps, and the queen glances at her with embarrassment.
I suppose I am a little nervous. Do I look all right, Daphne?
Of course you do. You are beautiful. Henry has said many times that you are the most lovely girl he has ever seen.
Did he really say so?
Somehow I doubt it. The boats launch toward the shore, lit with torches and lanterns, and garlands of flowers that go to waste, as they can hardly be seen in the darkness. They make landfall, and suitors disembark and pass by on the beach below, some nervous boys who mess up their bows, some laughing buffoons, like Michael Percy and Tommy Stratford, those poor suitors whom Arsinoe accidentally poisoned. The ones from Bevele wear black cloaks hung with gold and carry fat red roses. Those from Velostra are each dressed in different light wool stripes. Then, it is Henry's turn. He arrives on a launch lit with 9 lanterns.
One lantern for every great county of Centra, Daphne whispers to Ilion.
He looks very handsome in that black and crimson cape. Though, someone should have told him that crimson is for funerals.
Shall I wave?
Daphne chuckles.
I think he almost winked.
Ilion chuckles as well, and then stops. Below on the beach stands the final suitor, Brandon, the Duke of Bavon. Arsinoe feels Daphne swallow and begin to fidget, as Ilion and Brandon stare at each other. He is good-looking, to be sure, one of the best-looking boys that Arsinoe has ever seen, and she grew up with the likes of Joseph Sandrin. But there is something else about him that strikes her, above his looks.
Illy?
The queen does not respond, and Daphne clears her throat.
Illy!
What is it?
Should Henry be worried?
Henry should be more than worried, Arsinoe thinks. For there is something in Brandon's eyes
that reminds her distinctly of Queen Catherine's wicked king consort, Nicholas Martel.
Arsinoe! Arsinoe!
She jerks awake to find Billy's hands on her shoulders. They are still on the knoll of grass between the governor's stable and carriage house, and from the look of the sun, not much time has passed. Yet Billy is looking at her crossly, like she slept the whole party away.
What? What's the matter?
You said Henry again.
Arsinoe sits up and brushes herself off. Hmm? She tries to feign innocence, or perhaps confusion, but the blush creeps onto her face. Her scars must already be dark from it.
Don't play the fool, and don't play me for one. You called me Henry the other day when you wanted to borrow some socks. Now who is he?
Shouldn't we be getting back?
She stands and sees Mirabella approaching from the direction of the house. Billy gets to his feet beside her.
There you are!
Mirabella calls.
Arsinoe, stop playing with me. Have you met someone named Henry?
No, of course not. Why are you so upset? It was only a dream.
Mirabella arrives in the midst of their argument and looks from one to the other as Billy picks up his jacket and beats it free of grass.
If I were to dream and start whimpering and moaning, Christine, Christine, he says, I'd wake up to your hands around my throat.
Oh, no, Billy. Mirabella touches his shoulder. It is nothing like that.
Mira?
Arsinoe shakes her head.
Keep quiet.
We said no secrets, sister. Arsinoe exhales hard through her nostrils and turns away, the closest thing to permission she can bring herself to give. She has been having visions of the past.
Visions? Billy asks. I didn't think you had visions. Isn't that some other gift?
Not visions, I misspoke. Dreams. She has been dreaming through another queen's eyes, a queen from the Blue Queen's time, and she saw... She pauses, as though searching for a word. A specter. A shadow beside Joseph's grave. A shadow that looked like us. Arsinoe peeks at Billy from the corner of her eye. He is utterly befuddled.
But why would she be dreaming that?
I love it when you both talk about me as if I weren't here.
Arsinoe casts a glare at them. Then, before either can ask any more questions, she stalks quickly back to the party. Bastion City. It does not take long for Word of the Mist to reach Bastion City from the capital. In the bronze whistle, Amelia beats her fist against the table.
The mist rises and spits drowned bodies onto the shore, right at the undead queen's feet.
Mathilde leans forward, her arms around a cup of wine.
They say the corpses were torn apart, skinned, aged by years, when they had sailed only days before.
It is another sign, says Amelia.
It's rubbish, says Jules.
Fishers get caught up in the same squall, and sharks set upon the wreckage afterward.
It's a tragedy, to be sure, but it's not a sign.
And what of the aging? The advanced decay?
Exaggeration and fear, or simple misunderstanding. The sea can do strange things to a body. I've seen it myself back home. And you should know it as well here, so near the water.
Amelia and Mathilde trade weary expressions, and Amelia pounds her fist again.
Another sign or not, the time is right to move. Half of the people already consider Catherine to be an illegitimate queen, and the other half will say they do, if only to get rid of another poisoner.
Half and half, Jules snorts.
So she has no supporters then? The whole island is on your side?
Even the mist is on our side, says Amelia, and laughs.
She looks to Mathilde.
It is time. It is finally time to begin.
Yes, says Mathilde. A call to arms.
Both turn and stare at Jules expectantly.
as if Jules would stand and shoulder a blade, give a rousing battle cry, and charge straight out of the tavern.
"Don't look at me," says Jules.